Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey.
Another weekend already wrapping up on us, man. We're launching into a brand new week, a new week of uncertainty, Tim, because I'm done filming the Holzer Files. Season 2 is complete. All 13 episodes. I don't know what I'm going to do with myself until we start filming again. Maybe sort my sock collection? I don't know.
Well, hopefully there's plenty of Bombas socks in there. And of course, we have this show, too.
Well, yeah, I'm just saying, you know, I was so used to working 8 days a week, 26 hours a day, that now I don't know what I'm going to be able to do with time back on my hands. This is going to be amazing. Maybe I'll have to spend it with my family, Tim.
Well, yeah.
Maybe it's time to revisit, Wilma, what's her? Winnie,
yeah,
and
yeah.
My kids, Bam Bam and Pebbles. I don't remember any. It's been a while since I've been home, Tim. But I'm glad that we've wrapped everything up. Season 2 is in the can. We should be back starting with the Holzer Files in and around October 2020 with brand new episodes. I'm really excited this season, folks. And I want you to know, even poor Tim is kept in the dark. I'm not allowed to tell him a whole lot about what happens. Just, you know, I've talked to him off air about the fact that we've been to some remarkable places. He has an idea of about a handful of them, and that I've had some of the truly most unbelievable experiences this season, and I can't wait to share it with everybody. So for everybody that keeps emailing in, hitting me up on social media, wanting to know when we're going to be back with more Holzer Files, it is coming up this fall, 2020, I believe around October. So keep an eye out for it, and you guys are in for a treat. And if you haven't seen all of season one, you can find it on iTunes. If you go to YouTube, there's a Travel Channel YouTube page that they do there. I think they're $1.99 an episode. They're on the Travel Channel Go application. So there's a lot of different ways to catch up with season one. Well, let's get started, Tim. Our guest today is Lynn Monet. Her book is called Omnipresent. Just came out in July of 2020. And this is a horrific tale. Lynn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
When does this take place? What year did this begin for you?
It was in March of 2005.
And let me get this straight. I mean, it almost has that vibe of every horror movie you can imagine, right? A single mom looking for a home, a place to shelter herself and her family, and things go horribly wrong. Is that a pretty fair assessment?
Yes, it is. It exactly is that.
Now, when you're looking for this home, had you toured many of them, or did this one kind of stand out, almost call to you?
I had been looking for over a year. Of course, with my single parent income, I was limited. So, and a lot of the houses in the price range that I was looking for sold very quickly. So when this house came on the market, it literally just fell in my lap. It hadn't even hit the MLS yet. My realtor was speaking to the real estate person that actually listed the home before and was able to get the information on it before it was listed to the public.
All right. So you get this opportunity. You see this house. Is this that story where you go in and you kind of fall in love with it? Or were you just moving fast because you didn't want somebody else to come in and snipe a home you could afford?
A little bit of both. The house was beyond my wildest dreams in the income, and you know, with the price range that I was able to afford, it was a beautiful, beautiful home. But I also fell in love with it as I, you know, toured the house with the real estate agent.
And upon reflection now, you know, having the hindsight, in that first tour, did anything feel off to you at all?
Yes. Yes. We were having some trouble with the lock. And when I entered into the foyer, I was waiting for the real estate person to come in. And I was, just to kind of back up a little bit, the house was a split level house. So when you would enter into the foyer, you would either go upstairs from the foyer or downstairs. In the downstairs area, there was a family room with a fireplace, a bonus 15 by 13 foot room, the two car garage with a workshop. And then in the upper area, there was three bedrooms, two baths. There was a formal dining area, living room, breakfast nook, and kitchen. So I when I was waiting for her, I started to go up the stairs to peer into the living room. There was nobody living there. All of their stuff had been moved out. And in my peripheral vision, I catch the view of a young man hanging in the stairwell.
All right. For clarification, hanging meaning standing in the stairwell looking at you, or as if someone had committed suicide hanging?
No, someone had he had committed suicide. This was later verified by the next door neighbor.
Wow.
Who stated that the next door neighbor was the first house on the street. I mean, he was there before they even put pavement. It was a dirt road. And he remembered when the house was being built in 1976 and the family that built the house. And he was telling me that the original homeowners had a son who hung himself in the stairwell during the time that his parents were in an active divorce.
That's horrific. And you saw this on your initial...
I was in my peripheral vision.
How do you rectify that? Did you talk to the realtor about it, or were you afraid she'd think you were crazy?
Yeah, no, I didn't. And I questioned myself in that moment, actually, because it was in my peripheral vision. And of course, when I turned to look directly at it, there was nothing there. And I remember trying to rationalize it in my mind, thinking, ew, you know, why on earth would I think of something so horrible? This house is great. And I just kind of then let the thought be a fleeting thought and continued up the stairs and was admiring, you know, the living room and placing my Christmas tree where I wanted it in my mind and that sort of thing. So I didn't think about it again after that.
Did you ever have a fear that it was something precognitive, as though you might be seeing something from the future, as opposed to thinking it might be a ghost?
No, I didn't. I didn't think that much more on it after I saw it, because I just thought that, you know, that there was something with me. I'm like, why would I think about something so awful? And like, I just let it go. I didn't, you know, I was enamored with the house, and I was, you know, wanting to make it mine.
All right. So you obviously win this house. You get to move in. How soon after taking possession of this house did it start to show its dark threads?
The first day, actually. And
really?
Just to back up a little bit, when I went into the house the first time, there was a second viewing that day. I wanted to bring my children back before making an offer on the house. And my children and their friends actually saw the issues in the home before I was ever willing to admit it. However, bringing it forward on the day that we closed on the house and received the keys, I gathered up, you know, a taco dinner to go and have a floor picnic in the house, because, of course, there was no furniture or anything, and take my kids with me. And I was in the kitchen cooking the dinner, and my daughter comes into the kitchen. She's 13, and she said, "Mom, what'd you want? You know, Mommy, what did you want?" And I said, "I didn't call you." And she said, "Yes, you did." And I said, "No." She said, "You called me twice." She said, "And I answered you in between that I was coming. You called me again. What did you want?" And I said, "Listen, I swear on my life, I did not call you." And she said, "I swear on my life, you did." And then my son comes in, peering underneath her arm into the kitchen, and he said, "Mommy, I heard you call her too." So I rationalized it. I told my kids, I said, "Well, you know, Brittany's a popular name. Probably, you know, it's dinner time. Maybe there's a mother that's in her front yard outside calling for her Brittany to come home and eat dinner. I'm sure we'll figure it out. I'm sure you may end up making a nice friend with whoever this Brittany is. So, you know, and then we just let it go. And of course, my kids loved that idea. So they gleefully ran out after dinner, hoping to attract whoever this Brittany person was. And that's how it all started.
But they were hearing it already. It didn't even ping your radar at that point, though, that this might be something supernatural, or did it and you were just afraid to admit it to your children? You didn't want to frighten them in their new home.
No, at that time, it didn't even ping my radar. I wanted, you know, so badly to make it work. I mean, here I had just taken out a 30-year mortgage and, you know, I rationalized for quite a while.
Right. And people bear that aspect in mind. This was a single mom who'd just taken out a 30-year mortgage. So before you start sending me emails of, oh, this woman's nuts, the minute something happened, I'd have moved out. You don't get that opportunity all the time. It's not just that easy. You know, it turns into an Amityville horror style story where you just have to leave and you leave everything behind. And that's not a reality for most people. It just isn't. So, Lynn, that's just the beginnings, the bubblings of what's going on. What other type of phenomena started happening? And was it like a small, you know, kind of simmering roil, or did it just start to go into full on flash mode of activity?
It was immediate. It was the first day. But I would like to back up just a little bit. After I had seen the house the first time, I wanted to go back with my children and view it again before making an offer on the house. And we went there, and of course my children were thrilled to death. They gleefully ran down the hallway picking out their bedrooms, and you could hear the joyous, you know, sound that they were making. And when they approached me, I was with the realtor, and they asked permission to go downstairs. And I said, of course. And when my daughter came back upstairs, her eyes were big like a deer in headlights, and she said, Mommy, I don't want to live in this house. And of course, I thought that I, you know, misunderstood her. So I said, what did you say? And of course, I was embarrassed because I'm standing here with the realtor, and here's my daughter saying, there's something about this house that I don't like, and I don't want to live here. And I rationalized that. I thought, you know, maybe she's, you know, because she's 13, she doesn't want to move away from her friends. She doesn't realize that we're just 30 minutes from where we were living before, and we can pick them up and they can come over. So I went back, you know, I said to her, I said, well, this isn't really a decision for you to make. How could you not want to move in here? And that's actually when it started, even a little bit before I signed on the dotted line, and I should have listened to my daughter.
Did she give you any specifics as to why, or just that she was uncomfortable and didn't want to be there?
She was uncomfortable and didn't want to be there after going downstairs, but she didn't give any specifics at that point.
Okay. Now you sign on the dotted line. The house is yours. You have this mortgage. What happens and how quickly does it begin once you've moved in?
Okay, it begins on the very first day, and I'd like to also say we actually only spent 2 nights in the house out of 8 months that I owned it, because it was so bad.
Wait, the very first day. You only spent 2 nights in the house in the first 8 months that you owned it?
Yes.
Holy cow. All right, what happened on the first day?
Well, picked up my kids from school. We were going over there. We were going to have our first dinner. I had closed on the house and gotten the keys before the kids had gotten out of school. And we drove over. I had makings for tacos. We were going to have a floor picnic. And so I was in the kitchen. I was browning the meat. And my daughter, Brittany, who's 13 at that time, came into the kitchen and asked me what I wanted. And I told her that I had not called her. And she repeated, she said, well, you called me twice. And she said, and I answered you in between that I was coming, and then you called me again. What did you want? And I said, I swear on my life, I did not call you. And she repeated back, yes, yeah, I swear on my life that you did. And of course, then my son comes in, looking into the, just under her arm, looking into the kitchen, and said, Mommy, I heard you calling her too. And of course, at that time, I'm like, oh, you know, it's probably a kid across the street. It's dinner time, or Mom might have been out calling for, and they have the same name as you. You know, as Brittany, it's a popular name. And I rationalized it. And of course, my kids, you know, they ran out to the front yard after we finished eating to try to meet this other Brittany and make friends in the neighborhood.
So that was pretty innocuous. I mean, you know, hearing a voice, but nothing threatening. What happens next?
Well, the next, I went ahead and I cleaned up and we left. I made, you know, walked around and made sure all the lights and everything were turned off and we left. And I take the kids to school the next day and come back to the house by myself because I had people that were waiting to come in to put in wooden flooring into the house, and it had a light-colored carpet in it, and of course that wasn't going to work with kids. So I went in to pull some of the carpeting out and the stripping out myself to save money on my single-person budget so that I could have the floor ready, the subfloor ready for them to just come in and put the flooring down. So when I went back the second day, I went into the house, and I went in the kitchen, I went upstairs into the kitchen and put my purse down, and I turned around and I noticed that the inside of the stove light is on and the one overhead is on. And then I look up at the ceiling and the kitchen light's on, and I walked through the house and every single light was turned on in that house. And, you know, and I'm thinking, okay, this house is new to me. Perhaps the previous owners, because it sold kind of fast, left a key with a neighbor to watch over the house since they had moved out.
Tried to rationalize it, right.
Yeah. So I'm thinking somebody came in the house and turned the lights on. And I also was thinking that because, you know, it didn't get listed on the MLS right away, and I noticed the second time we came back there was a whole pile of realtor's cards on the counter of people that had come to look at the house. You know, I figured maybe another realtor came through after we had left and turned the lights on. So I literally go across the street to the neighbors and I introduce myself and I say, hi, I'm the new owner across the street. And I was just wondering, has anybody in the neighborhood that you know have been entrusted with a key to the house? Because when I came over today, all of the lights were on inside. And it was an elderly couple, and they said, you know, no, that they had not, and that they had actually taken a walk that evening and noticed that the lights were on in the walkway, but those were solar lights. So they would come on at dark anyway, but they didn't notice any lights on in the house. And I thought, well, maybe they're on a timer. You know, this is a little weird, but this house is new to me. You know, I'll figure out why the lights are turning on by themselves. And I just went about my business pulling up the carpet until it was time to go pick up my kids.
That's a little bizarre. Okay. But again, nothing threatening, just off, right?
Nothing threatening, just off. Yes.
Okay. And what unfurls next?
Well, after the day that I had met the neighbors, I'd finished up, I went ahead and made sure that all the lights were off this time, and I went through the house, I locked up everything, and when I got down to the deadbolt on the front door, I was having trouble because the key was in there, but I couldn't get it to pull out, and it would not turn. And finally, I managed to get it out, and I'm thinking, oh, man, I'm going to bring the WD-40 and just soak this thing, you know, so that this doesn't happen again. But I kept trying to get the deadbolt to turn when I had it in the door frame, and it wouldn't. So finally, I had to open the door, and I reached inside, and I locked the door, the knob lock, with my hand, and I shut the door and just left the deadbolt. And I went, and I left. Well, the next day, I drop my kids off at school, and I go to the house, and I go to stick my key in the knob lock, and the door just pushes open. I hadn't even turned the key yet. I just put it in, and it opened. So I'm thinking to myself, well, maybe the reason why the deadbolt wouldn't turn was because I didn't have it in the door jammed the right way. And I went ahead, and I went into the house, and I again went upstairs, put my purse down, and I went to the back sliding glass doors to open them. And I noticed that the pin to the sliding glass doors was dangling to the side. And I'm like, wait a minute. I distinctly remember using that. So that, again, I'm rationalizing. I'm thinking, you know, I'm stressed, I'm busy, I'm, you know, getting moved into this house, getting the kids settled. Maybe I thought I did and I didn't. So then I went into the garage and went to open up the garage doors, and they were also not locked. And again, I thought, well, maybe I didn't lock them. Maybe I unlocked them and thought that I locked them. But then I'm standing there where I had brought in boxes from my car the day before, and I had stacked them against this door that was also in the garage, but it led to an area that was like a workshop. And I noticed that the chain was dangling there, and I'm like, uh-uh. You know, those boxes are 3 feet out, and they are up to my chin, and I'm 5'9". The only way that could have been unlocked is if somebody had been in the inside of this house, it moved the boxes, unlocked the door, and pushed the boxes back into the position that I had them. So I was certain at that point in time that a neighbor had a key and somebody had been coming into the house. So I went back across the street, and I made mention to the neighbors. I said, did you notice anybody over at the house last night after I left, you know, with my kids? And they said no, that they hadn't. And I said, well, look, you know, I'm going to start having workers come into the house, and I don't plan on changing my locks just yet because we're not going to be moving completely in until the kids finish school. I purchased it in March, and the kids only had like 8 more weeks of school left. So I wanted them to finish instead of doing the transferring thing and getting papers lost. So I said to them, I said, if you notice anybody in the yard or lights on in the house when my car is not here, I want you to call me. Here's my phone number. And if I tell you to call 911, please call 911 and I'll be on my way. I'm like 20 minutes away. And they agreed to do it. And the wife spoke up and she said, listen, I'm not trying to be a nosy neighbor. She said, but I saw you yesterday out of my kitchen window. I was doing my dishes when you were leaving and you were having trouble with the lock on the door. She said, because you went halfway to your car and then doubled back and went and shook the doorknob to make sure that the door was secure. And I had actually forgotten about doing that. And so when she said it, then I remembered it, and that's how I ended up, you know, leaving that day, entrusting them, you know, that they would contact me if they noticed any kids playing in the yard or anything at that point.
Yikes. Okay. But your neighbors were acutely aware. I mean, they were noticing things and paying attention as well to you and your house. Does that phone call come? Does anybody let you know? Okay.
Nope.
So
no, never came.
Now this is in your first day or two in this house. When does it start to amp up for you? I mean, to the point where it's now just not an annoyance, but you're starting to feel truly afraid.
It was the first night that we spent in the house. I take that back. The first night that we spent in the house, my daughter had a friend sleep over, and the girl woke up at around 1-2 o'clock in the morning and wanted to leave. The second night was the very first time that I saw something that I could not deny, although I did rationalize it. I had been painting the bathroom, and it was around 11:30 at night, and my kids, I brought blow-up mattresses on the floor, and they were in the master bedroom with the TV in between, and they had watched a movie and fell asleep. And I went ahead to go into the kitchen, and as you come out of the hallway, you pass a little bit through the living room, then there's the stairs and then a railing there so that you don't fall over into the descending stairs, and then the kitchen wall, and I entered into the kitchen. I went ahead and I started rinsing out my paintbrushes and getting you know, cleaned up, and I was going to head down and take a shower, and all of a sudden I come back out of the kitchen, and out of my peripheral vision I catch this thing, just flashing, black thing flashing past the double white entry doors up the stairs in front of me and shooting down the hallway. So I'm standing there kind of frozen for a minute, and I'm thinking to myself, I've been painting with the window shut and breathing fumes. I haven't eaten anything since supper time. My sugar might be low. And maybe that was a car outside that passed under a street light and made that reflection. But really, logically, it didn't make sense because there would have been no way for it to have flashed down and then gone down the hallway, and then I hear my dog growling. And so I went to the end of the hallway, and my dog is standing there fixated on the doorway with the hair up on her neck. And I entered into the door. My kids are sleeping there, and I kind of reached down, and I pet her, tried to soothe her. And she put her ears down for a minute, but she still stood strong looking at that door. So I'm like, well, you know, we have the windows open. She's not used to being in a home with the windows open because the air conditioner's on. And maybe she has to go out to go to the bathroom. So I took her to the bathroom. She didn't want to come back in the house. And finally, I had to carry her into the house and settled everything in and then went to bed. And then that morning, my daughter woke up and she said, I asked her, I said, well, how'd you sleep? And she said, I didn't sleep very well. She said, I felt like there was something standing in the doorway staring at me all night long.
Yikes. Was this affecting your son as well?
Yes. In addition to that, my son got up that morning, and when he got into the car for me to take them to school, he had bite marks on his legs.
What? He had bite marks? And these weren't from the dog bite marks. Oh,
pardon me?
I was going to say they weren't dog bite marks. They weren't from your dog, but they looked like dog bite marks.
They looked like the mouth was a little smaller. And I asked my son, I said, oh my God, who bit you? What happened to your legs? And he didn't remember even being bitten. And he had three different bites on him, on his legs.
And they were fresh?
Upper and lower teeth.
They were fresh? But they were fresh bites?
They didn't look like fresh bites in the sense of welting. They looked more purple, like bruises that are left after the bites.
And was your dog prone to nipping or roughhousing with your son? And could those have been what you were seeing, like after effects of the dog playing with your son from an earlier time?
Nope. No, I actually, you know, he went in and had his bath and came out in his pajamas, and you know, I saw his legs. I would have noticed those bites on there. And my dog wasn't one for nipping. The teeth marks were upper and lower. They appeared to be dog bites, but the mouth was smaller than my dog would have left. It would have been much of a larger span. And the fact that if he had been bitten by my dog, believe me, anything that would have bitten to have left bruise marks, teeth indented bruise marks, like that, he would have known it.
And he had no explanation for this as well. Didn't remember bumping into anything or the dog messing with him, nothing.
Nope. I asked him, I said, what happened? You know, you've got bite marks on you. Who bit you? And he said, he looked down, he looked at the bite, and he says, I don't know. So
let's take a quick break. We'll come back. Lynn Monet, our guest, her book, Omnipresent. We've got a link up to her story on today's program. Make sure that you buy that book, go through the link that we provided, and check out the Darkness Radio store for more books. All of the books that you hear covered here on True Crime Tuesday and Darkness Radio are all in one place. Just go to darknessradio.com, click on the store tab, and it'll take you in. You can then click on our Amazon storefront, and we do collect all of the books from true crime, paranormal, and some really cool paranormal swag, from games to clothes, knickknacks, and more, all in one comprehensive place. You can find it all right there. We'll be back with more right after this.
Bombas makes the most comfortable socks in the history of feet. They have literally rethought every little detail of the socks that we wear to make them way more comfortable. In fact, I wear them every single day, and I wear them in a different kind of way. Let me explain to you. First of all, I don't have ordinary feet. I have extraordinarily weird feet. In fact, I have extraordinarily weird feet in the fact that they like to break down on me. You may be familiar. I've talked about them before. I have a normal foot on my left foot, and I have an extraordinarily terrible foot on my right foot. In fact, it's so broken down from diabetes that it's a Charcot foot. Look it up. It's incredibly French, incredibly rare, and incredibly broken. Broken in 100 and some places. I want to say it's like 50, 60, 70, something like that. But it all mended back together. And I wear what's called a crow walker boot. and it comes all the way up to right underneath my knee. So I can't wear a regular sock on that right foot. I have to wear a compression sock. So Bombas makes the best compression sock in the business. It's soft. It actually keeps you cool under this stifling Crowalker boot, which is made out of foam. Think of stuffing your foot into a hard plastic and non-breathable foam cast all day long, and it just sweats and sweats and sweats. Yeah, it's stifling, okay? But now put a Bombas sock that keeps your foot cool all day long into this stifling casket of a, that's what it is, the stifling casket for your foot. Bombas manages to keep my foot cool in the stifling casket for my foot all day long. Not only that, but does what a compression sock is supposed to do, which is keep that blood from pooling in that damaged foot of mine. And it does everything it's supposed to do wonderfully. I love Bombas. That compression sock is the best thing ever. And it does it with Bombas style. Focus on the good foot for a second here. The good foot gets a lovely Bombas quarter sock, which matches in color to the compression sock. That quarter sock, I love these quarter socks. Also has your typical, and I say typical, nothing is typical with Bombas, of course, but it has that great honeycomb arch that supports you where you need to. It's got the great seamless toe. It's got that great heel. Best of all, it keeps me warm in the wintertime, cool in the summertime. It's a perfect Bombas sock, which, by the way, I've taken my Bombas socks to my orthopedic podiatrist. He loves Bombas as well. Bombas is absolutely perfect. It is the perfect sock. You've got to try them for yourself. Now, these socks do more than just keep your feet cozy. We've talked about how cozy and how perfect Bombas is. They're perfect in other ways as well. They help give back to the most vulnerable members of our community, which is another reason why Beyond the Darkness loves Bombas so well. Because for every pair of socks that you purchase, Bombas donates a pair to someone in need. The generosity of Bombas' customers has allowed them to donate over 34 million pairs of socks and counting through their nationwide network of 3,000 plus giving partners. And we know that you, the listening audience of Beyond the Darkness, are part of those giving partners, and we appreciate you for that as well. The impact is more powerful than ever. To those experiencing homelessness, these socks represent the dignity of putting on clean clothes, which is a small comfort that's especially important right now. Here's what we want to do right now. We want to give a pair when you buy a pair of Bombas socks. And we also want to give you 20% off your first purchase at bombas.com/darkness. Take advantage of it right now. Go to bombas.com/darkness for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/darkness for 20% off your first purchase. Give a pair when you buy a pair. Let's become part of a giving partner and give back to our communities this summer. Go to bombas.com/darkness for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/darkness for 20% off your first purchase. Bombas.com/darkness. Do it today. Hey there, it's your buddy Tim. What kind of week have you had this week? I'll tell you what, I've had a pretty good week. It's been relatively pain-free. And I'll tell you why it's been pain-free. It's been because of my friends at Feels. That's right. You may be experiencing some stress. You may have anxiety. You may have chronic pain. You may have trouble sleeping at least once a week. I'll tell you, you're not alone. A lot of us do. I know I do, but I'm getting over it because of my friends at Feels. I was searching for anything that would help, but then I discovered Feels. What is Feels, you may ask? Well, Feels is premium CBD delivered directly to your doorstep. Feels naturally helps you reduce stress, anxiety, pain, and sleeplessness. And I'll tell you, in my situation, I've got chronic pain like you wouldn't believe. Just everything, but I've told you before, but the tip of my pinky on my left hand. This past couple of weeks, I had an issue with my left shoulder, my left hip, from a car accident that you guys may be familiar with from back in October. But I'm getting over it. I'm getting over that condition. But I've had a little bit of a setback because I was on crutches and I was on a knee caddy. But I've been getting some relief with feels. I've also been getting relief with arthritis, degenerative disc disease, also some herniated and bulging discs in my neck and back with feels. I'll tell you, I wouldn't be able to get sleep without feels. I wouldn't be able to get over some of the anxiety from chronic pain without feels. Sleep comes easier. I'm able to sleep through the night with feels. And I know I get a lot of your correspondence. Well, Tim, does this really work? Is this really something that actually works? Yes, it is. I wouldn't be here talking to you about feels if feels didn't help me get through the night. Feels is real easy to take. You may think, well, I'm a little over my head. I don't know if I can do this. You can. It's real easy. It's real simple. You just place a few drops of feels under your tongue, and you feel the difference within minutes. The thing to remember about CBD is that finding the right dose is important, and everyone's dose is different. Mine is real easy. I just take a full dropper full at night before I go to bed. I take a full dropper full before I take off and do my stuff for the day. But you may need room to experiment over the course of a week or so. You may need a few drops here, a few drops there. Maybe you need a half dropper full. Just depends on your tolerance. You may need to take more or less to get the effects that you're after. It's up to what your body tolerates. Now, although I'm here for you and I'll answer questions, I'm not the expert. You may be new to CBD. Feels is there for you. Every step of the way, they have a free CBD hotline to help guide you through your personal experience. Although, like I said, I am great about answering questions. I'm not the expert. Feels is. And they will answer every single question you have. Feel better naturally with Feels. Feels works naturally to help you feel better. There's no high. There's no hangover. There's no addiction. Many of us have been to pain clinics. Many of us who have been through this have been thrown every pill in the book. I know I've been through a lot of them. I kicked Vicodin. I was on Vicodin for years. CBD will help you get through that pain without the loginess, without the hangovers. You can do it. Now, join the Feels community to get Feels delivered to your doorstep every month. You'll save money on every order, and you can pause or cancel at any time. Although I don't know why you'd want to once you've tried Feels, by all means, you can do that at any time. Feels has me feeling my best every day, and it can help you too. Become a member today by going to feels.com/darkness, and you'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping. That's feals.com/darkness to become a member and get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. Feels.com/darkness. One more time, get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. Why stay in pain? Why do it? Why have trouble sleeping at least once a week? Why toss and turn? Why go through crippling anxiety? Treat yourself. Get yourself out of pain. Get yourself out of anxiety. Start sleeping at night. Feels.com/darkness. Do it today.
Lynn Monet, our guest today. The book, again, is called Omnipresent. You'll find a link for it in today's program. All right, this is really kind of unnerving, to say the least. The amount of activity that was taking place and leading up to that is absurd.
Well, and that wasn't even the worst thing that happened. The worst thing that happened, I was in the house, was that my best friend Ellen got clawed to the point of bleeding on her upper back between her shoulder blades and stomach while she was standing next to me in the kitchen.
Okay, so when does this happen?
This happens after we had spent the second night. And again, after me seeing that thing, we had kind of come away from it. I worked that weekend as a nurse. I've been a nurse for 34 years. And so, you know, I kind of started to doubt what I saw. So we come back, and I had gone back to the house, and I had a worker in the house that was putting in wooden flooring. And at that point in time, I was painting in the hallway, and I turned, and out of my peripheral vision, I caught a young man walking up the stairs, and it was so real. I mean, he had on a white Oxford shirt. He had, it looked like blue jeans or navy blue pants. He had kind of his cheeks were kind of reddened, either like he had bad acne or they were kind of sunken in. And he had brown hair parted down the middle, kind of 80s looking, for, you know, dress with the no socks and the penny loafers. And I turned and I looked and I said, "Did you knock?" Because I could see him so clearly in my peripheral vision. But then, of course, then when I turned and I looked directly, there was nothing there. So in that moment, I realized that there were, you know, all that there was a ghost in the house. The man that was laying the flooring in my son's bedroom, just paralleling me on the other side of the wall that I was painting, answered me, and he said, "Oh no, I dropped something." He thought I was talking to him. And that particular day, I packed up and left. I was a little unnerved. I went to get my kids from school and take them home. I wasn't planning on going back to the house that day because I had to work that weekend. I worked a Baylor shift. And so I was getting ready to do that. And the man that was in the house called me on the phone, and he said, "There's something strange about this house. I have to leave right now." And then the line dropped. Tried to call him back, couldn't get him. About an hour later, finally I get him, and he says, "Oh, it was nothing, but I would rather go back there when you're going to be there." And then he told me that he had left the windows cracked open and did not secure the house. And of course, I was going to be working the weekend and not going back there for about 3 or 4 days. And I didn't want bugs to get in the house, or it was kind of rainy season at that time. So I had asked my friend Ellen, who lived next door to me, if she would go back with me, because I was still a little unnerved and didn't want to go there by myself. So she agreed to go. And as we were going down the road, I kind of made mention that I thought that there was a ghost in the house. And did she have a problem, you know, going in with me? And if she did, that I understood, you know, that she could wait in the car and that I'd get the neighbor across the street's, you know, husband to help me. There was an air conditioner in one of the windows, too, that needed to be lifted in before the window could be shut. And she said, no, I don't have a problem with that. But when we got to the house, I started having trouble again with the lock. I could get the key in, then it wouldn't turn, then it would finally turn, and then you couldn't get it back out. And my friend Ellen entered into the foyer area, and she looked at me and she said, "Hurry up, come on, you're not going to let the boogeyman get me, are you?" Well, they targeted her. And within about 10 minutes of that comment, she and I had first gone down the hallway and pulled in the air conditioner and secured the window, and then we went into the kitchen, and I wanted to show her. My daughter wanted a wild horse theme in her room, and I had these wooden carved horse heads to drape her valance over her window. And Ellen was holding one of those in each of her hands. And I hear this buzzing, gurgling sound coming up behind me, which I had heard before, but I'm the only one hearing it. And she said to me, she says, "What's that sound?" And I said, "Can you hear that?" And she said, "Yes." I said, "Remember I told you about the ghost?" And she says, "Yeah." And all of a sudden she dropped both of the horse heads onto the counter. She started screaming. She said, oh, my God, what is it? What is it? A spider bite? It burns." And she's like grabbing her shirt to see if it was ripped. And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" She says, something's burning on my back." She says, "I think I've been bitten by something." And I lifted up her shirt, and diagonally between her shoulder blades, underneath her bra strap in the back, was a single claw mark that looked like a cat claw mark. And I said to her, I said, "Ellen, you know, I'm looking this at now as from a medical standpoint, and normally when someone gets scratched, the immediate response is welting. And even if you have a wound and the scab gets bumped off, you don't have that, you don't have that welting process again. And this thing was actively welting and beating blood in front of me, so I knew it was very fresh. And I said to her, I said, what happened? Did you, you know, did you snag the window on the car getting out? Or you've got like a 4-inch claw, you've got a 4-inch scratch here on your back. And she says, I don't know, I don't know. And then she started screaming again. And she said, it's got me on the stomach, it's got me on the stomach. And she lifted up her, her shirt, and sure enough, she had a claw mark underneath her belly button off to one side. At that moment, I told her, I said, we need to leave. And I started praying out loud, commanding whatever it was to leave. And it just kind of moved out of the kitchen and kind of hovered, this foggy thing kind of, you know, shifted into the dining room area. And I told Ellen, I said, you know, you need to go ahead and leave. I'm going to go ahead and lock up some of the things before we left. And then we went ahead and we left and went home. And she was complaining about the burning sensation on her all the way home. Interdimensionally, I could actually see an attachment on her.
You could actually sense something, or you were physically seeing something attached to her?
I was seeing something out of my peripheral vision attached to her.
Now, you say you could see this interdimensionally. Are you a psychic or a sensitive?
I'm an empath. I'm not, or I don't really call myself a psychic. I don't like read people's cards or anything like that, or tell them, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow. I am a sensitive. I have the ability to see interdimensionally. This comes in very, very handy in the nursing field, especially when someone is crossing, getting ready to cross over. I have a book that I'm writing right now about the actual process of dying and the actual death itself, and then the afterlife. The last 17 years of working as a nurse, I've been 34 years, but 17 of it was in geriatrics. So I have had the opportunity to see lots and lots of people pass away. And with that being said, I've also been able interdimensionally to see the effacing of the veil between both sides. And I can see the loved ones preparing for the welcoming of the being that's getting, the embodied soul that's getting ready to cross over. And medically, on the other side, I can see the embodied person getting ready for their rebirth into the other side. There's a preparation thing that goes on both sides, and I've had the ability to look into that. And of course, this brings oftentimes a lot of comfort for people, just knowing, you know, even with children, they say, you know, if they're okay, if they know where the person has gone, or even if their parents have divorced, as long as they can go see where mom or dad moved, they have a picture in their mind, so they're okay. And it, with adults, when someone's passing, it gives them comfort to know where they're going. And the loved ones also, you know, where their loved one has gone. And so it comes in handy with nursing.
But there's a difference between being empathic and kind of having the sense and actually seeing attachments. Is that something that you have always had the ability to do?
When I was a little girl, I did have the ability to see interdimensionally. I was raised in the latter part of the 60s into the 70s. And, you know, back in that time, that wasn't really something that was talked about, you know, except for amongst the family, and it was squelched. Of course, the family didn't want the neighbors to know what was going on in their house and that they had a kid that could do that. So a lot of times when I would bring up what I was seeing, I would get in trouble for it. And then as I got older, traditional religion kind of compounded the problem, because they would tell me that what I was seeing, whether it was good or bad, was demonic, and that I was going to go to hell because of having this ability to see. And of course, being a child with the demon thing and the going to hell thing, it scared the bejesus out of me. And at around 10 years old, I started to try to block my ability, and I would ignore what I was seeing, and I wouldn't talk about it anymore so as to appear normal. And eventually it kind of faded, and I only saw glimpses every once in a while. It wasn't something, I mean, it was never really constant, but I saw it less and less. And then when I, it reopened when I was exposed back to the paranormal activity in this house.
This has to feel overwhelming to you. I mean, this is all within the span of a few days of taking ownership of this house. How are you mentally mm-hmm. processing all of this, Lynn?
You know, sometimes when you're placed in a situation, you just deal with it as it comes. But having other people that had also come to the house with me and had met me there, also them seeing what I was seeing, of which I had 13 witnesses, that either encountered the beings in the house or they were attacked, and kind of validated where I was coming from. But yet in the same token, here I was stuck with a 30-year mortgage with a house. I had 30 days to get out of the place that I was moving from because I had sold it. And I was trying to make the best of the situation. So I started, I had gone online and started for the first time in my life looking through paranormal groups to have somebody come and get the things out of the house. I figured it would be, if somebody could come and do a blessing, then I could keep my house. Because I really, really liked the house. I really wanted to stay there, with my family. And I was determined to get those things out of there. And I had contacted I started with the Yellow Pages looking through churches. And I went through every single one. And most of them referred me to the Catholics. There were a few of them that proceeded to tell me that I wouldn't be having this problem if I attended their church. I had a few of them that accused me, because I was a single mother, that my promiscuity, of which I hadn't even had a boyfriend in 4 years at that point, was the cause of the reason why those things were coming at me. And I remember thinking, well, your slogan is, what would Jesus do? But I understand that you're scared and don't really know what to do either. So I kind of, let that go. But finally, I found a Presbyterian minister who was willing to help me. And also, I contacted a Georgia paranormal group that was led by Andrew Calder. May he rest in peace.
Oh, he was.
And he came out.
He was a very good friend of our show for many years, and a good friend in person
really?
As well. Yeah, Father yes, Andy. Yeah.
And he came out to my house and he verified that I did in fact have an infestation, and he did a blessing on the house.
Did that seem to settle things down?
For a little while. He explained to me, and just to back up, a lot of the I had like 11 to 13 different denominations of religion to come in there, and sometimes when they would come in, it would aggravate the entities and it would make it worse. When he came in, he explained to me that because I had such a bad infestation, he was explaining to me that as there is a hierarchy of angels, that there's also a sub-hierarchy going in the other direction of demons. And he said that certain levels of demons can do more things. And he said they can leave bite marks, they can leave claw marks, they can pull hair. He even was telling me that there were a couple of cases that he was working with where women were raped, and he was explaining the telltale signs of what that looks like. And so he explained to me that even though the blessing was done on the house, that I would have to continue to, send away any time that I would ever, see something in the house or whatever. And after that conversation with him was actually when I decided to move out, because I told him, I said, there is no way. I said, it's enough as a single mother and people in general to have to deal with criminals at large, but to have to worry about something coming back into my house. What if they come in when I'm sleeping? What if they come in and crawl in bed with me or one of my kids? You know, I'm not going to be able to stand up and scream at them to get out in the name of Jesus Christ. I said, and not only that, what if I'm having, you know, a family dinner and it's Thanksgiving and my family's come over and I see a demon walk through the room and I stand up and start screaming to get out in the name of Jesus Christ? Do you really think that those people are ever going to want to return to my house or, for that matter, invite me to their house because I might be bringing more than chocolate cake?
Sheesh. That's, I mean, that's overwhelming. It's, you know, I can't even fathom what it must be like to be in that situation. Now, you said you only actually spent two nights in that house in 8 months?
Yes.
So overnight, only twice. Mm-hmm. What happened to you? Where do you go when you own a house that you can't be in?
Well, I ended up, I stayed at the house that I was moving out of because I had had, you know, 30 days at that point. Actually, the house that I had was moving out of sold like maybe two months after I had owned the house. So we had a haven to go back to, and there were no problems, you know, at the other place that we were staying. It was that house. And what I learned in the process of all of this is that it's not about the age of the house. It's about the ground that it's built on. A brand new house can be haunted if it's built in the wrong place.
Well, you had what you believed to be or understood was a suicide in that house.
Yes.
Did Father Calder address that soul to see if it needed to move on? Or do you believe that whatever was in this home drove that young boy to that dark place?
I do. And actually the young boy was, he looked like he was about maybe 15 or 16 years old enough to drive. He was released. He was released. He had the opportunity during a blessing to, I was told to open the sliding glass door, and he was commanded to leave while the demons were held at bay. I do believe, and he ran right past me. I saw him leave. He ran so fast past me for the sliding glass door and the light. And the other entities were left behind. But I do believe that the entities, and what I learned some things too, which I'll share with you in a minute, but the entities were what caused him to do what he did.
You believe that they're what drove him to that point?
I do. And there are some other things that I've learned about mental illness and depression and demonic presences that I'm writing about in my next book that correlate with that.
Give us some insight into that. I mean, if these beings are there and predate even the house's existence, how do you think that they picked a parcel of land or why a certain area becomes this breeding ground for evil? Can you give us some insight into that?
What I learned, first of all, when Andrew came, he did do a history on the house. He went all the way back to 1976 when it was built, but not further than that. And he found where in the 4 years prior to my buying the house that it had been sold four times. It was also verified to me that the people that I bought the house from actually only physically lived in the house for 6 months. And this was verified also by the neighbor next door who said that they had moved out after 6 months. So what Andrew was explaining to me, and he actually got pictures of the ghosts, was that, you know, this land, the Civil War came through. It was in East Flat Rock, North Carolina. The Civil War came through. There were a lot of Indian things that came through. There were hanging witches. All kinds of things were happening on those grounds. And any one of those things could have set that off. In addition to that, I had another person that had come to do a blessing on the house, and when she pulled into the driveway of the house, she had a friend with her, and she said to her friend, she said, "They're tunneling." And she pointed at the correct side of the house, which was where those things, the two demons and the young man seemed to hang out most of the time, was downstairs near the fireplace. It was a stone fireplace, and there were minerals, of course, in the fireplace, and they seemed to kind of like that. But she told me at that point, she said, if your house had been built 3 feet over from where it was, you wouldn't be having this problem. And she started to talk to me, and she said, you know, this house across the street over here, Caddy Corner, and the one behind it, I bet is haunted too. And she said, because the path leads over there. So what was explained to me is that how they got into my house was where it was built was an interruption to a path that they tunneled, or they call them ley line, whatever they are. That, and because I had that stone fireplace, it seemed to be where they were coming into the house. And that's what I was told.
So it was almost this spiritual flow, this river of spirits that ran through that area, and the structures stop that flow. And for listeners that may be rolling your eyes thinking that sounds insane, you have to realize that there are a lot of cultures who very much believe in these pathways, these energetic or spiritual energies. There are buildings in, I believe it's in Japan or China, that are built at specific angles. Some of them have holes built into them so that the energy can move through them, as opposed to feeling blocked by these structures. So this isn't just a concept that is harebrained. I mean, many cultures believe in this. And if your property, this house, is built in the middle of this traffic flow, creating this kind of logjam of spiritual or negative activity, I've got to guess that just creates a whole new, you know, problem that most of us as paranormal investigators just would never, you know, probably have never even really run into. This sounds like a real rarity.
Apparently it is. However, she was correct about the houses that she pointed out. I mean, what she told me was so bizarre that it actually made sense, if that even makes sense, because what I had experienced, what she was talking about, made sense. So the house that was catty corner to me was a rental property. And literally in the 8 months that I lived in that house, it had three or four different families move in and move out. And the one that was behind it that she said, I bet is haunted, stayed empty the whole time that I lived there. It was abandoned. Nobody lived there. So also, when she came in and did the clearing, she did some Indian rituals. She came in and she did the clearing on the house. You could go down into the lower level, which is where they like to hang out, and in the sage smoke, you could see where the tunneling was, and it almost looked like it was packed with paper or something that it was packed with when she finished.
Now, did you ever address the former owners after this to find out if they had dealt with any of this and why they maybe didn't disclose it to you?
I did not. But when this house dropped into my lap, my realtor was telling me that the husband had been transferred to a job, so they had already moved out. And they were really anxious to sell because he was paying a mortgage on a house somewhere else and couldn't afford to pay for both mortgages, so there were motivated sellers. And so when the closing came and I met the couple, it turned out that they were living with his wife's parents just 20 minutes from the house, and he never was transferred to another job. He was still working at the same place. And I thought, well, you know, I'm not going to question it. Obviously, they're moving for personal reasons, and I'm just grateful to have, you know, the house. And I was kind of talking to the wife at the closing, and I was telling her, I said, oh, yeah, I'm going to put some wooden flooring in, you know, for the kids. And da 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 da. And she just kind of kept looking down at the ground and would not even make eye contact with me. And she said, yeah, that's what we wanted to do. I know they knew. I know they did.
If you only spent two nights in this house, did you ever move in full time? Did you ever feel like it was officially cleared for you?
Well, I thought so. Yes, at one point, Andrew had come and left. He said that it would be okay to be in the house. But again, he warned me. He said, you had such a bad problem with it. You still need to be very aware and you still need to continue to stand your ground with that. And he was actually upset with me because I threw in the towel. I'm like, nope, I'm not doing this, but he said, no, you have to. And I said, look, I cannot be at peace every time a paper blows off of the table thinking that they're back. So I'm sorry, I kind of lost my train of thought here.
No, that's fine. I was just asking, having had all that experience, did you ever move back into the house?
No, I did not. I had all of my furniture moved into the house. I had, 4 workers, only one of which stayed. The other ones came once and never came back. They didn't even want to be paid. One guy left his DeWalt tools and told me to leave them out in a box in front of the garage, and they sat there for 3 weeks, and he never came and picked them up.
Would they ever tell you specifically what happened to them? Or just that something happened and they were uncomfortable?
There was one of them. One of them was related to a friend of mine. He was her cousin, and he was between jobs. And I was desperate because at that point, my 30 days were dwindling. I had sold my house my other place at that point, and I had the 30 days to get out. And I needed to get my furniture out of the place and situated and into the house. And he was actually the young man that was there with me when I saw the ghost coming up the stairs. And that particular day, he, of course, wouldn't tell me what happened, but I asked my friend. I said, hey, listen, when you see so-and-so, ask him what happened in the house because, he never came back. And so 4th of July came, and he was visiting at her house, and he had a beer, and he was feeling a little talkative. And so she asked him point blank what had happened. And he said to her, I am so sorry that I did not finish that job, for Lynn. She's a very, very nice lady. He says, but that house is words that I can't use on the radio up. So I'll just do the beep, beep, beep up. And he said, I couldn't go back there. And so she asked him, well, what happened? And he said that he was in my son's room continuing to lay the wooden flooring, that he had a mallet and a trowel to put the adhesive on. It was tongue and groove flooring with adhesive, and a block of wood so that he could gently tap it in without messing up the tongue part of the flooring. And he put in a piece of the flooring, and he went to reach for his tools, and they weren't there. And so he was sitting on one of these wheelie seats, like a garden seat, wheeling. So he thought maybe he'd wheeled over them. So he's scooting and he's looking to see, where his tools are. And then all of a sudden he looks over to the door that exited into the hallway, and there his tools are paralleling each other perfectly in front of the door. And he told my friend, he said it spooked him, but he thought that maybe I had come back and that I was playing a joke on him by sneaking in behind him and moving his tools. So he's like, well, I didn't move them there, but they're there. So I must have missed something. And he got up and he admitted that he was shaken by it. And he picked up his tools and he went ahead and he proceeded to turn the light on. And he had a little battery operated radio, and he turned that on, and he proceeds to sit back down on the wheelie seat, and he puts his tools down next to him and uses the trowel to put the adhesive on, and he's going to put in another piece, and all of a sudden the light shuts itself off. Then his radio shuts itself off, and he can hear the tools scooting. And when he turned, he said they were like, they just lined themselves up exactly where they were before in front of the door, and he said he couldn't get out of there fast enough. And that's when he left that I had to go back that day to secure the house, and Ellen got clawed.
Wow. I mean, that's a lot of activity compacted into a short amount of time. Did you allow other people to stay in your house when you weren't there to investigate, to explore, and see if they could figure out who or what was there and why?
Only if they didn't believe me. No, I'm saying that a little bit. It is funny, but I contacted the closing attorney, realtor attorney that closed the house, to try to see if there was some loophole that I could get out of the mortgage. And of course he said no, and he wanted to know why. And I told him, I said, well, the house is haunted. I said, you can believe it or not, but I need to know if there's something that I can do to get out. And he's like, oh, it's haunted. No way. And I said, listen, if you don't believe me, my furniture's in the house, the refrigerator's running, the electricity's on, there's hot water. You and your family are more than welcome to come and stay in my house for the weekend. And you'll be the only ones here. And he, of course, declined. And the funny thing is later on he told me he was closing on a house that was creepy and that he felt something. So he came forward. But it just, you know, there were people. Actually, more people came to me stating that they needed help or that they wanted to express to me their experience that they had had at another time in their life. And they said, yeah, this is the first time I've ever talked about it because I know that you'll believe me. So there was a lot of that sort of thing too.
Was it, I mean, that had to be heartbreaking for you to find a home that you could afford, find this opportunity, and now you can't live there. There's something else forcing you out. Do you regret not keeping your ground, not standing your ground, or because you were a mom and your kids and your safety come first, are you satisfied with the path that you took?
Yes, I am. I couldn't, I mean, as a mother, I couldn't imagine the effects, the post-traumatic stress that it would have created on my children. To live in a situation where your child gets up during the night and comes to you and says, there's something under my bed, or even worse, in my bed, and there really is. You know, they can't come in and pile in with mom and have the sheets pulled off. So it just, I couldn't do that to my children. I needed to have my home be my haven and be able to come home and relax. And that was not going to happen for me in that house. I had been violated. I tried everything, and I was violated again and again as far as, you know, things happening that weren't supposed to happen. And I never could feel at peace in that home, ever. And that's why I didn't stay.
When you, did you eventually sell the house, or did you just let it go into foreclosure, if you don't mind me asking?
I did sell the house. I would have preferred to have burnt it to the ground, but being a single mother, I couldn't afford to pay for a home for my family and for a home for the unwelcome guests to live in. So I went ahead and I put it on. I had the repairs finished. The last guy that came in, had him finished putting in the wooden flooring and doing something with the stairs to make the steps bigger. And of course he was stoned all the time. So for some reason, being high, he wasn't affected by being bothered by them, I guess, because he carried one on his back. But anyway, so he was able to finish the work. Out of the four men, he was the only one. And I didn't care that he was stoned all the time, as long as the job got done and I could get out, and as long as he didn't do it around my kids. So I went ahead and I put it on the market. And a couple with three kids came by to see it, and they wanted it so badly because it was in the neighborhood that she had grown up in and similar to the house style house that she grew up in. And the children that came with them, they had four children, and the fourth one was not with them. And so the kids, of course, mimicked exactly what my kids had done. They were running down the hallway, picking out their bedrooms, and then they came and wanted to go and look downstairs. And the one little girl and little boy, they come back up and they say, I overheard them telling the third child, Bobby can have the creepy room, you know, and because the one little girl wanted a bigger bedroom. Yeah, she had the smaller room, and she wanted a bigger room, and she's like, nope, I'll take the small room. He can have the creepy room. So they actually saw them. And in that moment, I realized as a mother that I could not, in good conscience, sell the house to anyone with children, because children, a lot of them under age five, they don't have filters, and they're able to see interdimensionally. And it would be horrifying, you know, for them.
So what did you tell the family?
Right after they came to look at the house, there was a second couple that, like myself, came up from Florida. I had no idea that the area was haunted as all get out, and that there were books written on how haunted the area was. So they came up from Florida, and they toured the house with me. They fell in love with it and wanted to buy it. It was a cash buy, so there wasn't even any mortgage, you know, that they had to wait to get money for. And so I told the family that I had found somebody that wanted to buy it with cash buy. But in the process of signing some papers in the house, as we were leaving, coming down from the upper level to the foyer, I overheard the wife say to the husband, "Why did you push me?" And he said to her, he said, I didn't touch you. And she said, "Yeah, you pushed me." He said, "Honey, I'm three steps back from you. I can't even reach you, and I'm holding on to the rail." And she said, "Well, I don't know what happened then." And in that moment, I knew that I had to say something. I wanted to come clean and be honest, and I didn't want to do to them what had been done to me, even though I understood why. So when they came out the double entry doors, I said to them, I said, "Do you believe in ghosts?" And they came out and they said, "Nope, we're Baptist. We don't talk about those sorts of things. We don't believe in those sorts of things, and we're protected." So they cut me off. Now, if they had asked me, I would have been honest, and I would have told them the truth. But they didn't want to know.
And did they end up eventually purchasing the house then?
They did.
And
they purchased the house.
Do you know if they stayed there as well? Did they follow through, or did they end up getting pushed out?
Well, about 6 months later, I was kind of curious, and I was in the area. So I mustered up the courage to take a quick drive-by past the house. Now, the house is on a dead-end street, so I started to, you know, feel a little ambivalent about turning onto the street, because if I passed it once, I had to pass it twice, and the house was the second one in on the left-hand side. And as I was passing the street, I noticed that there was a sign in the front yard, but I couldn't tell where it was placed, if it was actually in the neighbor's yard or in the yard where the house was that I had sold. So I went to the next street, and I turned around because I really wanted to know what the sign was. And I said a little prayer for protection, and I mustered up the nerve to drive down the street. And I even said a prayer, "Please do not let these people come outside while I'm passing their house, because they'll recognize me." And sure enough, it was a for sale by owner sign. So, you know, at that moment, my heart just dropped, because I had really, really hoped that my efforts to extinguish the problem in that house would have been successful enough that these people that bought the house from me would be able to enjoy the home. And I realized in that moment that it had not, that I had not been successful. So I went to the end of the street, and I turned in a driveway to come back around. And I had a little bit of music playing in the car. And as I'm passing the front of the house, my radio blares, and I'm trying to turn it off and turn the sound down, and it wouldn't. So here I am now in front of this house with my radio blaring. So I sped up and I got to the stop sign, and I turned off of the street, and my radio immediately shut off by itself. And I realized in that moment that my driving on that street, they knew I was there, and they wanted to make sure that I still knew that they were there. And I never went back.
Wow. It makes me wonder, you know, I mean, there's like websites like diedinhouse.com. that'll actually show you all the owners. That might be interesting to take a look at and see how many owners since you left it and what's really happened there, maybe even uncovering some of the other deaths that are known on property. Did you keep in touch with any of the neighbors?
No. No, I didn't. I mean, I owned the house for 8 months. Like I said, I only spent two nights in there, but I would come on a daily basis. And after it was determined that there were entities in the house, I stopped bringing my children, and I would not go there by myself. I always needed, you know, I had somebody come with me. And it just, you know, things, and I actually, my mother started getting attacked by the entities in the house. I would come in, I would go to do a prayer and a blessing, trying to clear it on my own, because one of the main reasons that I wrote the book was because there's so little help out there for this kind of thing. People want to come, you know, and take pictures of the ghosts and post them and, you know, and that sort of thing, and that's fine, but I needed somebody that could actually get them out. I didn't need them to be identified. I wanted them gone. And there are so many people when you're in that situation that come forward and say that they are capable of doing that. And in the price range that I had to spend, there weren't, you know, as many, but they didn't, and they couldn't in a lot of cases. And, you know, then they would either disappear, you know, of course the refund's not an option, or they, you know, or they would tell you that they needed to come back additional times to do it. And, you know, I wasn't interested, you know, at the point anymore.
After you left that home, did you ever feel as though the spirits visited you, or that maybe you had taken part of them with you at any point?
No, I didn't. When I stopped having my children go to the house, then they went back one more time and I found that the things were still there. I started moving back into the house. I started bringing their toys home and making arrangements to have the furniture brought back. The sale of the house, I actually canceled the sale of the house that we were living in and gave them back their money so that we could move back in there. And when I started bringing the things over, I started looking online of how to bless things, because I didn't want to bring home anything with my kids' toys, you know. So I blessed the furniture. I blessed the boxes that the toys were in, holy water, salt. I did everything that I could to protect my family. Once we moved out of that house, there were no ever again further issues like that, where there was a demonic presence. But how it affected me is that it reopened my ability to see interdimensionally. And that's, you know, the gift that I still have today.
Do you look at that as a gift or a curse to have that ability to see these things?
I actually, now that I'm grown and have a better understanding of spirituality and things like that, I do see it as a gift. It has brought such a great comfort to cancer patients that are not, you know, that they're terminal, or people, it has brought so much comfort to them. Also, it has come in very handy in my field where, and I had made mention that I am writing another book that will hopefully be out in the fall, if depending on how long a copyright takes, but that talks about mental illness. And I had gone back to school to further my education as a nurse, and I had to do this rotation through a psychiatric ward because it was a psych class. And we had gone into, there were eight nurses and a teacher, and we had gone into this section that was the intake section. And this young girl comes up, you know, she comes to me, she's pointing at me, and she says, "You can help me, I know you can." And of course, I'm like looking over my shoulder, is she talking to me? You know, who's she talking to? I hope it's not me. And the teacher, you know, intervened, and she said, "Don't make eye contact, let's go." So we were ushered into another area. But I had requested to come back into that section with another nurse that came with me. Even though it was high risk, there were combative people. They were just coming in, and I sat down at a table, and the girl comes over to me, and she starts telling me her story about how, you know, she had been molested when she was 5 years old from her pastor until she was 10, that her mother remarried and she was molested by her stepfather until she was 16. And I'm sitting here and I'm looking at her, and she is covered in these scratch marks that were exactly the same kind of scratch marks that I saw on Ellen, my friend in the kitchen. And I'm looking, and she says, yes, and I hear 25 different voices. She says, and there's one of them that has a long fingernail that claws me. And she said, and I'm looking, and I'm like, I'm noticing that some of the scratches on her body are in positions on her, you know, in areas that would be very hard for her to reach with her own hands and make the line that straight and at that angle. So I kind of knew what I was thinking, that it was, you know, she had been attacked by demons. So she got up from the table, and she said to me, she said, you know, I know you can help me. Will you come and pray over me? Well, of course, I didn't want to do that because I felt that whatever was going on with her was beyond my scope. And I surely didn't want to be bringing things home after I had experienced what I did in that house. But when she got up to start to walk away into the distance, interdimensionally, I'm looking at her, and over each shoulder, it looked as if she had a clear bag full of potatoes. They were shaped funny, but when I looked at them, they were faces. Some of them, the eyeballs were inverted on the bottom, and she had one over each shoulder. And I thought to myself in that moment, oh my God, that lady really is hearing 25 voices because they're attached riding around on her back. So when I went into, we had to do this rotation for like 4 weeks. So as I went back into various institutions, I started looking at the people that were hearing voices and in an interdimensional way. And a lot of them had attachments. Now, the ones talking about pink elephants, they were mentally off. But the ones that seemed to be talking about hearing voices often had an attachment on them. I did go to the girl before I left, and I told her what I saw. And I told her, I said, you have some attachments on you. When you leave here, you need to find someone that can help you take those off. And, you know, and hopefully that will rectify your problem. So I don't know if she did or not, but I did tell her.
It's a fascinating story, a fascinating life. I've got to guess, Lynn, that in opening this up, do you have any concern that by sharing this story, you'll draw the attention of whatever these dark forces are again?
I'm not afraid. The one thing that I learned is their ability to, how can I word this? Their ability that they fuel themselves on people's fear, and they fuel themselves on anger and depression and addiction and all of those things. They fuel themselves in order to even be able to be seen or to be able to move something. It takes a lot of energy, which is why it's not a good idea to have one in your house, even if it's harmless, because they do a certain energy draw, and they distract you in your sleep, and then you don't get sleep, and you become depressed, and then you have other medical problems that go on and on. But and I just lost my train of thought, but with that being said, I just lost my train of thought.
Well, hey, let me ask you, I mean, for people out there that are listening, that are going through something like this, before we say goodbye, what is your advice to them on how to deal with these kind of infestations or hauntings?
Okay, well, if I may, and I do want to say they need to find someone that's qualified to remove them. I don't recommend being in a home with somebody that has a ghost, good or bad. The other thing that I wanted to touch on, and that I think that's very important to me, is part of the reason also why I wrote the book is in the very last chapter, there is a self-help section. And in that self-help section, there's a simple technique that anybody can use before signing on the dotted line for rent or buying a house. But it also discusses how, what is the appropriate behavior to have if you are in a house that's infested. And it also addresses a subject that is very much overlooked, the children. I educate parents in this book on how to teach their children to empower themselves when they're faced with an entity or entities that makes them feel uncomfortable. The worst thing that a parent can tell their child is that nothing is there. Just because the parent can't see it does not mean that it's not there. And in my experience, a child's subconscious are open from birth to age 5. And they have no filters. Therefore, oftentimes, they're able to see interdimensionally. So if a person's child comes to them and repeats seeing the same entity or group of entities over and over, you need to ask, is your invisible friend or is that, you know, person that you're seeing or whatever it is that you're seeing making you feel uncomfortable? And do not tell them that it's their guardian angel or Aunt Lulu coming to watch over them, because if it was really their guardian angel or Aunt Lulu, they wouldn't be scaring them and shaking their bed in the middle of the night. So there's this chapter in there to assist with that also.
All right. Well, please keep us in mind. Let us know as more things evolve for you and when your next book comes out. Would you do that?
Yes, I will.
All right. Thank you so much, Lynn Monet. Again, the book is called Omnipresent. We have a link for it in today's program guide so that you can find it easily. Remember to rate and review these books as well. Thank you so much for tuning in. Be safe. And if you are going through something like this and you feel overwhelmed, you can always reach out to Tim and Dave and tell us your story, include your contact information. We will try to put you together with an expert that might be able to help you in your area. Give us a email, dave@darknessradio.com. That's dave@darknessradio.com. There's no reason people should be alone in this. Please don't send these messages to me on Twitter or Facebook. Those messages get lost very easily. If you just send me an email, dave@darknessradio.com, that is the best way to communicate with us. We'll be back Tuesday with a brand new True Crime Tuesday. Back again next weekend with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave. That's Tim. This is Darkness Radio.